Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, happy Sunday, wherever you may be in the USA or around the world. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio, and I am broadcasting to you from Boise, Idaho. Western Idaho State Fair, terrific event. I'm going to tell you a little bit about all the people I've been meeting, the discussions I've been having, the general attitude of folks in Boise, which mirror, by the way, the attitude of the folks up there in North Dakota, another great event, and the folks in Sarpy, Nebraska, and the folks in Wyoming at the Wyoming State Fair. There seems to be a consensus, and the consensus does not bode well for the folks in power. We're going to be talking about our historical story today. The historical story today is going to be brief. It is the worst generals, or at least some of the worst generals, in United States history. And we can add to that list now the current Joint Chiefs of Staff, particularly General Milley. I have warned you about General Milley for several years, and here we are. Did you know that they're talking about court-martialing soldiers who don't want to take the vaccine that's not a vaccine? And there's more. Unfortunately, there's more. And we're going to be talking a little bit about H.R. 1, which the House passed. You know, the, as the New York Times call it, the voting rights bill. Really, it's the voter suppression bill. Or should I say the legal voting suppression bill. And there is no coincidence that it got passed the other day, folks. There's no coincidence at all. It's all tied in with Afghanistan. I'll explain to you. We're going to talk about Biden, President Cadaver, and why President Cadaver, unless he tips over, and even then there may be a double, why Biden is going to stay in power, because the Democratic Marxist Party and the puppeteers that control it want him in power. And there's a bunch of reasons, and it has to do with their agenda. It also has to do with the shield, the foil for their follies right now. And by the way, not follies. Everything that's happening is intentional, and that includes Afghanistan. We're going to talk about Afghanistan, not just the human toll, but what we left for the Taliban. Radical Marxist Islamists. The absolute epitome of the totalitarian state. The antithesis to everything American, everything constitutional, and everything we say that we stand for. You know, the no race problem, and the empower women deal, and the educate our children deal. But we turned that country over to them, and we turned it over with all our military equipment. And when you hear the stuff that they have their hands on now, and it's not just military, it's also high-tech surveillance. You know, our friends at the big tech companies that put it together for the military and the corrupt previous Afghan government to monitor their people and to supposedly track the Taliban. Well, it's all going to be turned around by the Taliban right now to track us and track all those Afghans who trusted us and work with us. And we're going to talk about the housing market. There's some things you really need to know. I mean, I watch this like a hawk, and that there are stats out there that are not coming your way on purpose, I might add. And we're going to talk about China relative to the housing market, because, you know, it seems that China is buying a lot of U.S. real estate. Why would they be doing that? And, you know, look, I could go on and on and on today, but I'm not going to. Next week, we're going to have a whole different set of segments, court rulings. I'm going to put them all together for you so you know what's going on in all these various courts around the country on all sorts of subjects and should we say, hiccups, intentional hiccups that are going on around the United States, the fundamental transformation of the United States conducted like a symphony by Barack Obama in the shadows of President Cadaver. How convenient. And we're going to be talking about giveaways to China. Oh, yeah. You didn't know what Obama and Cadaver are doing in terms of empowering China at the expense of the United States. That's coming next week. And we're going to talk about food shortages, because there are food shortages, and it's not going to get any better. And we're going to talk about that next week, too. But let's focus on today's show. As an aside, folks, you'll notice my voice is a little hoarse, a little raspy. That's because I've been talking to literally thousands of people here over the last 2 weeks, which we're going to be discussing during the show. And many of you have, in one way, shape, or form, gotten to me and wanting to know exactly how you can submit comments, letters, whatever. So let me go over that for you again. On the Right Side Radio at Reagan.com. That's on the Right Side Radio at Reagan.com. You can go to our Facebook page, On the Right Side Radio. Please do. Throw us a like and pass it on. Have other people throw us a like. The more people we reach, I think the better for the country. And you can also send an email, a comment, to the website, on the Right Side Radio. com. So, On the Right Side Radio at Reagan.com, Facebook, On the Right Side Radio, and the website, On the Right Side Radio.com. Before I get started, thank you for your letters. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate it a bunch. The other thing we're going to be covering today is some incredible stats that are coming out of Europe on the so-called Delta variant. You know, we're all going to die of the Delta variant. So we better get that vaccine. We better get that jab. And we better take all the boosters. Well, you know, that's not what the science says. That's not what the stats say. And these are European studies, which, of course, the American press isn't touching with a 10-foot pole, just like they're not touching the million people in the streets in Australia saying, hell no. Which, by the way, we really need to start doing. We really need to start doing. I got some comments on this last show from several listeners. You know, you were talking about COVID, and COVID is kind of a passé thing, and you need to be talking more about this, that, or the other. Folks, COVID is not a passé thing. It's not a passé thing because, you know, lots of people are going to get sick with COVID. And almost all of them, without exception, are going to recover, just like you do with the flu. But why it's not a passing thing is that COVID is being used by the press and by the Democratic Marxists to try and steer election fraud in 2022, because they know they're in trouble, folks. They know they have a problem trying to keep the House, and probably have a problem trying to keep the Senate. And they're going to do everything they can, just like they did in 2020, to cheat you out of your vote and to fraudulently steer an election. It is treason. And one of these days, we're going to recognize it for what it is, and those who are behind it are going to be held accountable. To the nth degree of the law, the constitutional remedies for treason, which is exactly what they deserve. Let's get started. The worst generals in military history. Let's begin with the worst generals in United States history who now have a compatriot in that sorry category. Wouldn't it be great if all the generals in U.S. history were George Washington's or Ulysses Grant's or George Patton's? Yes, it would, but they have not been. And every nation, it's not just the United States, has good generals as well as bad ones. And the politically connected generals that kowtow to the current agenda of whatever administration it happens to be, they are generally the worst, although there are exceptions. These are five of America's worst generals. Horatio Gates. You might have heard that name. Well, Horatio Gates was a backstabber. He was a guy who made it a lifelong ambition to take down George Washington to better himself. He was a former British officer. He rose to fame as a Continental Army commander during the American defeat of the British Army at Saratoga in 1777. Now, many historians credit, believe it or not, Benedict Arnold and others with being the real victors of Saratoga. Gates, however, thought otherwise, and he was not above enlisting his friends in the press to promote himself, shall we say. And he fancied himself a way better commander than George Washington. You know, let's get rid of Washington and put me in. By the way, as an interesting historical sidelight to Gates, it is Gates taking the credit at Saratoga that embittered Benedict Arnold, and that was the genesis of Benedict Arnold's treason at Ticonderoga. Let's talk about during the darkest days of the rebellion, Washington's army had been kicked out of New York. King George was kind of having his way with the colonials. And there was a Conway cobble, if you will, of disgruntled officers and politicians who were unsuccessfully scheming to get Washington out and appoint Gates. When Gates was sent to command troops in the South, he had poor tactical decision after poor tactical decision, and his army was routed by smaller forces of redcoats and Tory loyalists in a number of battles, but notably at the Battle of Camden in South Carolina in 1780. You know, Washington suffered his share of defeats, but he had persistence. He had inspiration. He had a love of country that kept the Continental Army in the field through the worst of times. That's why his face is on the $1 bill. If Gates had been in command, folks, we might be paying for our groceries with shillings and pence. And then we have George McClellan. You might know a little bit about him, too. I mean, there was Braxton Bragg, B-R-A-G-G, and Ambrose Burnside, horrible generals for the Union in the Civil War. But the worst was McClellan. He was called the Young Napoleon. Lincoln and the Union expected great things from him. McClellan was a superb organizer, let's give him that. He was a West Point trained engineer. He did much to build the Union Army almost from scratch. But in terms of being a field commander, being a general, understanding tactics and timing, he was horrible. He was overly cautious, as engineers many times are. Coming up next, more on George McClellan, a general who did not general. Lincoln kept pleading with him for aggressive action. He had the powerful Army of the Potomac at his disposal. But McClellan convinced himself each and every time that the Southern armies vastly outnumbered him, when just plain logic should have told him that the North enjoyed an abundance of resources and an overwhelming advantage in supplies, materials, and men. The Union had the factories of New York and Chicago. And Lincoln knew that the only way the Union could lose the war was if the North eventually grew tired and agreed to allow the South to succeed. So he wanted to push forward with big battles. He wanted to go on the offensive. Or he was quite sure, and he was probably right, that the United States would have split into two countries. McClellan hesitated and hesitated and hesitated. In the skirmishes that he did engage in, he would withdraw long before the battle was over, worried that reinforcements from the South were coming, that he was going to be surrounded, you name it. He was replaced by Ulysses S. Grant, one of our greatest generals. And had Lincoln retained McClellan and not canned his butt, probably many former Americans might still be whistling Dixie. Then we have a general by the name of Lloyd Friedenhall. That's Friedenhall. He was the ignominious commander of American troops at Kasserine Pass in Tunisia in 1943. He was a major general and a corps commander. Should I say a corps commander? I'm using Obama's terms, corps. If there was a saving grace for America, it was he wasn't commanding an army. Friedenhall, to his defense, was dealing with many issues. He had woefully inexperienced U.S. soldiers who were up against Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps veterans. The Americans didn't have sufficient troops, supplies, or air cover. They, in fact, were the ones being bombed by the Germans incessantly during this battle. Friedenhall's solution was to order an army engineer company to build a giant bunker 100 miles from the front line for he and his staff. He also issued orders to his troops in personal codes that no one else understood. I'll give you an example. This is an actual communication from this general. Move your command, i.e. the walking boys, pop guns, Baker's outfit, and the outfit which is the reverse of Baker's outfit, and the big fellows to M, which is due north of where you are now, as soon as possible. Have your boss report to the French gentleman whose name begins with J at a place which begins with D, which is 5 grid squares to the left of M. I'm not making that up. That was actually a communication by an American general to his troops and commanders in the field. Unbelievable. The Kasserine disaster had significant repercussions, kind of like Afghanistan is going to. It was a humiliating baptism of fire for the U.S. Army in Europe. And from that point on, British commanders pretty much dismissed their Yankee allies as amateur soldiers for the rest of the war, which created all sorts of conflicts, particularly between Montgomery and Eisenhower. You know, there is no action that does not cause a reaction. Next person, this next general in the list of America's worst generals might surprise you. Douglas MacArthur. Oh, I know there are those of you who are going to jump up and down and go, what are you talking about? But you know, much goes into being an effective general. And listing him as one of America's worst generals, despite his military achievements, is going to be controversial. But you know, MacArthur was a controversial dude. He was a capable warrior, no doubt about it. His South Pacific campaign and the Incheon landing in Korea were brilliant. But he also displayed, as you probably don't know because you know, history is written by the victors and we have to have our heroes. He also displayed remarkably bad judgment. When he was the commander in the Philippines in 1941, although he was informed that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and were certain to attack the Philippines next, MacArthur failed to disperse his aircraft, the only force that could disrupt the Japanese offensive, since there was no American fleet left, and to attack Japanese airfields before the enemy wiped out his air force. His crowning achievement of bad generalship, however, was in Korea. Yes, the landing in Incheon unhinged the North Korean offensive, but he rashly advanced into North Korea. He overran his supply lines. It was a blunder of strategic proportions, which of course is rarely covered in the history books. He advanced in dispersed columns across the northern half of the peninsula, and it was an invitation for the American and Allied forces to be destroyed kind of piecemeal. He advanced to the North Korean border with China, which was a huge red flag for our old buddy Mao Zedong, who feared that American troops on his border was a prelude to a U.S. invasion, which, by the way, MacArthur kind of beat the drums on. I mean, he was not his own best friend when it came to this. And perhaps Mayo would have intervened anyway. But MacArthur's strategy certainly, absolutely, helped unleash 300,000 Chinese so-called volunteers who inflicted significant casualties on the United Nations forces and American forces. And then, instead of holding a natural defense line around Pyongyang, which would have given the United States and the United Nations control of most of the peninsula, he retreated his armies all the way back into South Korea, which was a humiliating reversal for U.S. power after the U.S. and its crushing victory in World War II. And then there was MacArthur's insubordination. Now, you know, I'm not a big guy for authority. I think a little insubordination here and there is probably a good thing, particularly when it's motivated by love of country. But he called for the bombing of China, as if liberating Korea was worth risking 550 million Chinese screaming across the border, and possible war with Russia as well. Whatever his military wisdom, or the lack of military wisdom, it was a decision, and it was a public statement, and really a series of public statements, that should never be made by generals under the American political system, which gives us, unfortunately at the current time, control of the army by civilians. And he made his disagreements with President Truman were vitriolic and public, and Truman fired him. And then we have Tommy Franks. Tommy Franks was a general in the early days of the 2003 Iraq War. And it was, you know, the Iraq War, there's many things we can say about that, but it was bound to be kind of a graveyard for military and political reputations. And given the misperceptions and the misjudgments behind, let's face it, our ill-fated adventure in regime change and nation building, which led like a domino to all the other crapola that we're facing in the Mideast right now. Franks, however, who commanded the invasion, made a bad situation worse. Franks and senior officials, like Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who, by the way, I thought in many respects was great, concocted an invasion plan that used too few troops. You might remember back to those days. Do you remember we rushed in, we knocked the piss and vinegar out of the Iraqis in a matter of weeks? We were in Baghdad. But then, we did not have a force large enough to slice through what was left of the Iraqi army and secure, most importantly, a country the size of Iraq. There was almost no planning by Franks for what would happen in the days after Saddam Hussein was toast. Like it or not, the U.S. military became the governing authority. And if it couldn't or wouldn't govern the country, who would? Well, we know that, right? Power fills vacuums, and power has filled the vacuum, or the vacuum of power has been filled in the Mideast by Iran, one of America's mortal enemies. America, the Middle East, and the rest of the world are still reaping the consequences of those omissions and decisions. Let's remember Truman's words when he fired MacArthur. I fired him because he wouldn't respect the authority of the president. I didn't fire him because he was a dumb son of a bitch, although he was. But that's not against the law for generals. If it was, half to three-quarters of them would be in jail. Brings us to General Milley and the current Joint Chiefs of Political Staff and the debacle in Afghanistan, and by the way, throughout the military. Did you know that prior to this incredible mess in Afghanistan, intentional mess, I might add, we'll get into that here in just a moment, the Afghan army was the 27th largest army in the world, and, according to President Gaddafi, one of the best equipped. And you know, he's right. They were equipped with all sorts of American weapons, and planes, and tanks, and armored vehicles, and howitzers, and technical surveillance. You know, big tech, let's track you, let's recognize your face, let's control your activities, and put you under a microscope 24/7, 365. We're going to talk a little bit right now about exactly what we left behind in Afghanistan. We destroyed nothing. We are not making any attempt to destroy anything right now. We made no attempt to get billions of our taxpayer money funded weaponry out of that country. This is exactly what happened. I talked to you a little bit about last week when Barack Obama armed ISIS and armed Al-Qaeda, which unfortunately Ambassador Stevens died for because, you know, it had to stay hush-hush. It is a repeat of Obama's policies. It is a repeat of him intentionally arming, using United States taxpayer money, the enemy, radical Islamists, and Marxists, who are his brethren. Remember, in Obama's mind, ISIS and the Taliban and others like them are the freedom fighters against the evil colonial powers. In this case, Barack Obama's own country, the United States, us, of what we left behind in Afghanistan. And by the way, what we left behind in Iraq when ISIS overran that country because Barry decided not to bomb them despite the pleas of his chiefs of staff is staggering. Staggering, folks. Let me give you an idea. Over the course of a number of years, the U.S. has provided $83 billion worth of training and equipment to the Afghan army. This year alone, this is the year Afghan fell, we provided $3 billion of military aid. Putting price tags on the equipment that's still in Afghanistan isn't an easy task. Number one, it's being hidden by the Department of Defense. Oh, what a surprise. And hidden, of course, by the press. And the Biden administration, President Gaddafi and President Obama, are now hiding all the key audits that were performed on Afghan military equipment. Isn't that interesting? If you want to check out some of this, check out OpenTheBooks.com. They reposted two key reports on the U.S. war chest of military gear in Afghanistan that have disappeared from the federal websites over the last week. Oh, my. Imagine that. It must be a coincidence. The Government Accountability Office, the GAO, provided an audit of U.S. military gear in Afghanistan in August of 2017. This is billions and billions and billions of dollars ago. That's now a dead link. A special inspector general for Afghanistan reconstruction, which is called SIGAR, S-I-G-A-R, all caps, he did an audit of $174 million in lost Scan Eagle drones in July of 2020. That's now a dead link. That report doesn't exist. U.S. taxpayers paid for these audits, folks, and they paid for the equipment that was audited. And you know, I think we ought to be afforded the information to kind of follow the money. By the way, the GAO, when questioned about the sudden removal of these audits and information on military equipment, said, I quote, "The State Department requested we temporarily remove and review ports in Afghanistan to protect recipients of U.S. assistance that may be identified through our reports and thus subject to retribution." Folks, I've seen these reports. They only have numbers. They don't have any recipient information. There is nothing in these reports that could be tracked back to Afghan allies. It's just blatant lie. And this is all being done under DOD auspices. You know, General Milley, our next, quote-unquote worst general in United States history. To give you an idea, in terms of trucks and pickups, we've provided 42,000, I'm going to round numbers here, I'm not going to give you the down to the last truck or last vehicle or last rifle or last howitzer. We provided 42,000 trucks to the Afghan military. We provided 22,000 ambulances, cargo and troop transports, gun truck, moving equipment. We provided, in terms of Humvees, almost 9,000 Humvee-type vehicles. How about 1,000 howitzers? 1,000 howitzers. Top-of-the-line artillery. MRAPs. You know, those armored vehicles to carry troops and their mine and missile resistant. 928 of those. And then tanks. Oh, yeah. Let's give the Taliban tanks. M1 Abrams tanks, no less. 190 of those. An idea of the cost of this armament. Armored personnel carriers, 170,000 each. And the new carriers cost 333,000 each. Mine-resistant vehicles range from $412,000 to $767,000 each. Just those vehicles are somewhere in the neighborhood of $382 to $711 million of our taxpayer money now funding and arming the enemy. Recovery vehicles, 168,000 to 888,000 for the super strength versions. Medium range tactical vehicles like 5-ton cargo and general transport trucks, $68,000 each. The bigger transport trucks, 235,000 to 724,000 each. Cargo trucks which transport airplanes and airplane parts, $800,000 each. Humvees, like the ambulance type, let's say, or the cargo type, or the troop transports, anywhere from $37,000 to $329,000 each. Light tactical vehicles, fast attack combat vehicles, $70,000 each. Passenger motor vehicles, I mean, you know, let's drive around in some luxury here in Afghanistan, $65,000 each. All-terrain four-wheel vehicles, $42,000 each. And then, of course, we have the helicopters, and we have the transportation and cargo airplanes, and light attack airplanes, and intelligence gathering and reconnaissance airplanes and drones. The Taliban folks have seized Black Hawk helicopters and A-29 Super Tucano attack aircraft, all the latest gadgetry, all American technology. It is mind-boggling. Black Hawk helicopters cost $21 million plus or minus each. 20 A-29 Super Tucano attack aircraft, $427 million. That's $21.3 million each plane. Specialized helicopters, reconnaissance helicopters, can go up to $37 million each. The Afghan Air Force, oh yeah, okay, the Afghan Air Force, they have 7 planes for $84 million in cost, $12 million each. These are sophisticated planes that carry Hellfire missiles, anti-tank missiles, and other weaponry. The PC-12 intelligence, reconnaissance, surveillance airplanes use the latest technology. All these planes have fallen into Taliban and therefore Chinese and Russian control. Read up more on this debacle, this incredible cost, and this absolute breach and undermining of our national security and military by traitorous generals and traitorous democratic Marxists who are pulling the generals' strings. Talking about the sellout of the American public, American security, and the American military by the top brass and the democratic Marxists who run illegitimately this government right now. Let's continue. The enemies of the United States now have all our superior firepower and all our superior technology and reconnaissance. This, think about what this means to the United States Armed Forces. While General Milley and his cadre of political animals there in the Joint Chiefs of Staff kowtow to the Democratic Marxists because they don't want to lose their jobs. You know, diversity. They're focusing on diversity and critical race theory training. Oh, and the latest thing is, you know, how are we going to get the 30 to 40% of the military that has said no to the jab? How are we going to get them to do it? Oh, I know what we'll do. If you don't take the jab, we're going to court-martial you. I'm not making this up. This is unbelievable. It is treason. Treason. Basic fixed-wing airplanes, like the ones I've been talking about, range in price from $3.1 million to $22 million. And the helicopter prices, you know, general purpose helicopters, $92,000 to $922,000. Observation helicopters, $922,000. You know, the Taliban probably don't have the people to fly our planes, but the parts are hugely valuable, particularly to the Chinese, the Russians, and particularly the Iranians. The control stick for certain military airplanes that have now fallen into their hands, just the control stick, has a value of $17,800, and fuel tanks sell for $35,000. So to the extent the Taliban don't have the men, don't have the technical expertise to use this stuff, it is readily saleable. We are financing the enemy as well as arming them. And then there's the drones. Did you know that in 2017, the U.S. military lost, where was this news story? $174 million in drones that were part of the attempt to help the Afghan National Army, joke, defend itself. The SIGAR audit on the $174 million in suddenly missing drones has disappeared from the website of the United States government. And since 2003, the United States has given the Afghan forces 600,000 infantry weapons, M16 rifles, 162,000 pieces of communication equipment, once again, highly technical, highly sensitive, and 16,000 night vision goggle devices, and this is according to the GAO report. And you have machine guns. By the way, the average cost of an M16 rifle is $749. Some of the more specialized versions go to $12,000. M4 carbine rifles are slightly more expensive. Unit prices as high as $1,278. Just the sights, folks, on a night vision sniper rifle scope, which I'm kind of familiar with, can run as high as $35,000. Although most are just, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 for the scope. Machine guns, latest stuff, M240 model, $6,600 to $9,000 each. Grenade launchers, $1,000 to $5,000 each. Army shotguns, $150 each. Military pistols, $320 each. The pistol of choice being, which the Taliban now has, 40 caliber Glock Generation 3s. And then we have aerostat surveillance balloons at $8.9 million each. By the way, each Scan Eagle drone, you know, all these missing drones, gee, I wonder if we'll see them flying over the skies of the United States and over stadiums and gatherings of people. Wouldn't that be a Taliban, radical Islamist, democratic Marxist, Chinese, Russian delight? But how would they get them in here? Oh, that's right, that open southern border. How do you like how all this works? Radio equipment. Receiver transmitters at $210,000 each. Very sophisticated, state-of-the-art radio sets, $61,000 each. Repeater sets, $28,000 each. Deployment sets to identify frequencies and to scramble and garble messages so the enemy can't listen in. Gee, I guess they know how to unscramble our stuff now. $18,000 each. You know, it is unbelievable. By the way, 7,000 machine guns, 4,700 Humvees, 20,000 hand grenades, 2,500 bombs, 1,394 grenade launchers. That was all in this removed, mysteriously removed, Seagar report. It was reported by The Hill, by the way. Great job on that. This is unbelievable. And this is treason. And the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff are worried about critical race training for troops, vaccines for troops that don't want to take them, and court-martials for those who refuse, and diversity training, and transgender operations, while we are suffering a military defeat of enormous consequences in all sorts of ways. I mean, folks, the repercussions of what's going on in Afghanistan are going to ripple through our economy, through our military, through the Mideast, and through the world for decades. This is just the first chapter of this mess. And I wish I could tell you that that was the end of this incredibly sorry story, but like a bad infomercial on late night TV, there's more. Don't go away. We have a twofer for you. On top of all the attack helicopters and rifles and drones and vehicles and night vision goggles and uniforms, the list of military gear is endless that we left behind, that we could have destroyed or we could have removed from the country. This is the United States. We do have transport planes. What you didn't know is that Bagram Airfield, a state-of-the-art airfield, was left intact, as was another. And that troops were abruptly, I mean, like almost overnight, ordered by General Milley and President Cadaver, i.e. President Obama, to leave that field and leave everything intact. All their vehicles, everything parked in neat rows, just like they were at the air bases in Iraq when ISIS overran that country with Barry's help. Barry's direct assistance, shall we say. However, it's not the end of the story. There's recent photos of Taliban fighters, especially, by the way, the guards of top Taliban officials, and they are totally kitted out. They're wearing the same kind of tactical ball caps, even, that are favored by American Special Operations Forces. Assault rifles, body armor. I mean, Taliban fighters now look almost identical to their American counterparts. And the U.S. withdrawal, I wouldn't call it a withdrawal, I would call it a purposeful and intentional rout and panicked exit, leaving many behind. We'll talk about that in a moment. Also includes massive surveillance apparatus and equipment that the U.S. and its allies set up in Afghanistan. Everything from biometric identification to databases of personal information, active monitoring of cell networks is now in the hands of the Taliban. Oh, and the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians, I might add. Gee, you think that our Afghan allies are, you think that they're safe, folks? While there's concerns over how the Taliban may use the U.S. surveillance, oh, concerns, yes. We're so concerned here in Washington, D.C. swamp. The window for action has already closed. This snafu should remind us of a constant refrain kind of surrounding the 20-year Afghanistan war. Probably we should have never been there. We had the air power to do the whole nine yards. This vast surveillance operation that the Taliban and all the enemies of the United States can now take advantage of is a symbol of fear. It is a symbol of future Taliban authoritarian, complete totalitarian rule. And it's an indictment of America's governance in Afghanistan under a number of presidents. It affirms, unfortunately, that the U.S. and its allies were able to hold the country, but tenuously, and only through a violent campaign of kleptocratic That's the only way to really phrase this. Warlordism, which was supported by U.S. technology, surveillance, and air power. Surveillance technology, which is now in the hands of the Taliban and others, is one of America's growing export industries. Gee, you think there's any kind of payoffs going here in the under-the-table stuff? You know, the stuff you lose in Afghanistan that goes to the enemy, you got to replace. Oh, we get to buy more. How, this is terrific. What a great deal for the American public and the American military and American security. Government databases, which telecom all call records, taxes, tax registrations, voter registration files. There is a range of resources that were not destroyed, that were left behind, that a more technologically adept Taliban, and they can certainly get help from Russia and China, who would be delighted to bring them into the technological age. Politico had an article. I'm going to give you a quote. "The rapid takeover of Kabul left large stores of data open for exploitation inside Afghan businesses and government offices." The new Taliban minister, folks, who is now in charge of telecommunications, can now order phone companies to produce lists of everyone in Afghanistan who ever called an American or an American diplomatic facility or an American military base or military personnel. Geolocation data can now be used to see who visited someone's house or who stepped foot on a NATO military base. The former Afghan government, which was a corrupt piece of caca, started collecting biometric data about Afghan citizens, including, by the way, its own military personnel, in 2006. This is also this Politico article, by the way. And Politico basically outed the U.S. government. Quote, "The U.S. government helped the country set up the ability to wiretap and monitor phone calls for surveillance purposes." And this is by a government, the former Afghan government, defined by corruption, self-dealing, and the administration of death squads. There have been some late-in-the-day efforts to destroy equipment and scrub data. U.S. government websites have removed videos and signs of Afghan and American collaboration, along with information, like I told you about, that the American public is absolutely entitled to. Social media companies, oh yeah, we could trust them, have joined, offering tools to let Afghan users and people with friends in Afghanistan lock down their accounts so people can't see it, so surveillance can't get in there. You know, ordinary Afghans, panic-stricken, some of them trying to get out of Kabul airport, which is a disaster, are purging their phones of forbidden music and trying to pretty much erase their digital identities. It's too late. It's too late. Taliban fighters are already using handheld American provision biometric scanners at checkpoints and in house-to-house searches. For every surveillance system that has been destroyed or database that has been deleted, many remain. Some probably for sale in the secondary market or to be used as negotiating tools to gain favor with the new Taliban regime. Personal data in Afghanistan, folks, has been weaponized by the United States, who, shall we say, ignored its responsibilities to the Afghan people, the Afghan government, and to the American public and American security. Up the conclusion of this disaster in technological databases and warfare that are now in the hands of our avowed enemies, and the horrific human cost of this disaster in Afghanistan, which the Democratic Marxists could not care less about. And then we're going to do some real estate, Chinese real estate, and housing real estate, stuff you didn't know, because, oh yeah, that's being hidden from you too. Up this military debacle, get into the human cost of Afghanistan, which the Democratic Marxists couldn't care less about. Then we're going to get into real estate, Chinese real estate, and your house, stuff that you don't know, that you need to know. And finally, we're going to we're going to wrap up in the last segment of the show with the real stats on the so-called Delta variant. Oh, we should be very afraid. Well, not so much. When the U.S. solicited names of Al-Qaeda fighters for its rendition flights to Guantanamo Bay, it led to the imprisonment of numerous innocent people who were reported by aggrieved neighbors or other enemies. And since then, this aerial surveillance, the cell phone location data, the so-called patterns of life data, have been kind of the algorithmic heart of the drone war program that has produced so many casualties. Gee, you mean the missing drones? Is this all tied in somehow? Yeah, you bet it is. Over the last 20 years, Afghanistan was really kind of a technological training ground. Okay, this is an article in the Daily Beast. And the scale of the project that was instituted by the United States, and to a lesser extent its allies, is stunning. Quote, the Pentagon had a goal to gather biometric data on 80% of the Afghan population. The Pentagon likely didn't succeed in that ambition, but another digital ID system, I'm still quoting here, run by Afghanistan's National Statistics and Information Authority, reportedly processed more than 6 million applications. And the United Nations, folks, oh, they're right in there too. You know, they're our friends. They're the friends of liberty. The United Nations has its own biometric systems that now track more than 1.5 million Afghan refugees. This is a disaster. A disaster. The human cost of Afghanistan is staggering. Nobody really knows, nor will the government tell us, how many Americans are still stuck in Afghanistan. The numbers range anywhere, or the estimates range from 5 to 40,000. Many news media outlets are hovering in the 17,000 range. There are tens upon tens upon tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Afghans, panic-stricken, being sought and hunted down like animals like the Taliban, using the surveillance that America left behind, and then killed using the weapons that America left behind. The bombings at the Kabul airport, the killings of Marines, none of this needed to happen. All of this was avoidable. It is intentional, folks. There is only one silver lining to this incredible mess, which will have repercussions for decades, and that is it has actually opened the eyes of a portion of the American public that is asleep at the switch. I mean, if you can turn on the news, even mainstream media in some cases covering this, and think that this is right, think that this government is functioning effectively and competently and in the best interests of the United States, well, then you need some serious lobotomy work. Serious lobotomy work. Let's talk about real estate, because if we talk about more about Afghanistan, my eyes are going to pop out of my head, and foam is already coming out of my mouth. To real estate, let me give you another kind of rat-a-tat-tat. These are elongated rat-a-tat-tats today. Everybody's calling for the impeachment, the resignation of Biden. Folks, President Kadaver is there for a reason. He is a vacuous shell. He provides a foil and a line of defense for the people who are really running the show, the Soroses and the Gates and the Obamas. They can point to him and say, well, you know, he's a doddering old fool and he just doesn't know better, when in fact they know exactly what they're doing. He is hugely valuable to him. In addition, they can't remove him because then commie baby, Kamala, will be the president of the United States, who, by the way, was also chosen because, even though she's not senile, she's also vacuous. I mean, this is not an intelligent woman in any way, shape, or form, nor is she a caring human being. She is a democratic Marxist who walks in lockstep and takes her orders from the powers that be, namely the Obamas and the people above them. If Biden is removed from office, through any means, doesn't matter, it's not going to happen with impeachment, obviously, or through the 25th Amendment, or whatever, Commie becomes a president, and the vice presidency is vacant, and the Constitution is very clear. The vice president of the United States is the president of the Senate. She is the tie-breaking vote for the Democratic Marxist plot to fundamentally transform, you know, go back to Barry's words in 2008, to fundamentally transform the United States of America. They have to keep her there, which means they have to keep Biden there. It's really that simple. And I'll tell you something else. If Biden tips over, which, by the way, could happen, the guy's had two aneurysms. He's obviously not in good health, mental or physical. Don't be surprised to see a dummy. Don't be surprised to see the death of the President of the United States covered up so that Kamala Harris can remain Vice President, quote unquote, and the President of the Senate. These people frauded an entire country, an entire world in the 2020 election. Do you really think that they would not try and pull off a caper that allows them to complete their mission of fundamental transformation? Well, you know, if you do, let me tell you that I have a bridge I'll sell you. I got some lakefront property. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona that you would love to buy. Which brings us to real estate. So, you know, you've heard all sorts of things about the housing market and all this stuff that's going on. Stats that you need to be aware of behind the scenes of the housing market. The sales of new homes rose 1% in July. Annual rate now of 708,000. And that's from the Census Bureau. That monthly rise would have been bigger, except that June was revised up from a rate of 676,000. Sales had fallen in February, April, May, and June as prices obviously took off. There were surging lumber prices and labor supply was scarce. Home prices definitely continued to skyrocket. The median price of a new home in July rose to $390,500. That's up 18.4% from the previous July. The average sales price in July hit a record $446,000, up 17.6% from a year ago. But, and this is a big but, far fewer of the new homes being sold are on the less pricey end of the market, which is where most folks are at. They're not at the high end. They're in the middle and the low range. Back in 2019, homes that were priced at $399,000 or less were 67.7% of sales. That has now dropped, as of last month, to 50.5% of sales. Homes priced under $150,000 accounted for 1.9% of the market in 2019. Last month, they were so low that they weren't even assigned a percentage number. Houses in the $150,000 to $199,000 range were 7.6% of the 2019 market. Last month, just 1.5% of the total housing market. And houses in the $200,000 to $299,000 range went from 33.2% of the overall market to 22%, a 33+% reduction. At the same time, $400,000 to $499,000 price range went from 13.9% of the market to 22%. $500,000 to $750,000 range went from 13.2% to 17.5% of the market. And more expensive homes, which were 5% of the market in 2019, are now 7.9% of the market as of July, last month. What is happening is you are seeing and hearing about price increases. But it is more and more becoming lopsided to the upper ends of the housing market. And folks who are trying to get into starter houses, or folks that can't afford a $400,000 house or $500,000 house, are being not only priced out of the market, they're being unable to find a house that they can even buy in that price range. And on the farmland side, on the ranch side, land, there's other disturbing trends. True. The House Appropriations Committee, they were bipartisan. They took a tough-on-China stance. They've limited Chinese investment in U.S. farmland. But guess what? They're big pals in the pension funds and in foreign investment funds, including nationals from Canada, the Netherlands, Italy, Germany, and the United Kingdom, who, by the way, combined own 22 million acres of United States farm and ranch land. Not so much. And pension funds are now buying hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres. Their holdings are in the millions of acres. Particularly a pension fund called TIAA. Their investment manager is Nuveen. And they also own, they have $1.7 trillion in assets, by the way. They also have holdings in Australia, Chile, New Zealand, Poland, and Romania. But this is a global trend of retirement funds and others, foreign nationals, adding farmland to their portfolios, in part to hedge against holdings in more volatile stock markets. Quote, one of the key elements we've seen in the U.S. context specifically is the role of pension funds investing in land as one important player in this broader category of corporate actors. It's pretty interesting. I'm going to talk more about this next week because it's very, very important. The American Farmland Trust did a study. There's major changes going on in agriculture and ranching. 40% of the agricultural land is owned by people 65 years or older. Pretty amazing. And 370 million acres, think about that, will likely change hands over the next 20 years. Real estate developers are going to be prime competitors for land that are sold to non-family members, particularly in suburban and urban areas. About 11 million acres were used for real estate development between 2001 and 2016. And many times that land, river bottoms, flat lands, in desirable areas because of precipitation and weather, is the most fertile grounds. I'm going to bring you a lot more on this over the next several weeks. This is a very disturbing trend, not only for family farmers and ranchers, but for the United States population and our food supply as a whole. In other news, oh yeah, you know, the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi's little personal palace, they passed H.R. 1, which, if enacted into law and not successfully challenged at the Supreme Court, who, by the way, gave us a great decision. They enforced or they upheld Trump's Remain in Mexico policy at the southern border. Not that that matters, because between the Democratic Marxist DHS director, Mayorkas, and President Kadaver and Obama, I mean, they're going to ignore the court's order. You mark my words. We're going to be talking about this in the coming months, the complete flaunting of the power of the Supreme Court by the Kadaver administration. But H.R. 1 was passed by the House, not coincidentally, as this disaster in Afghanistan is unfolding. Why? Well, because, folks, they realize that what's happening in Afghanistan, despite the other benefits to Democratic Marxists and their radical Islamist chums, has serious consequences for the 2022 midterms. And if they lose the Senate, or they lose the House, or Biden tips over and Comey can't be the president of the Senate, as we were just discussing, then their agenda is done. It's over. It's halted. They got to keep the House. And the only way they can keep the House, despite their jumping up and down talking about their 85 million votes and their supermajority and their mandate, is to cheat. Just like the only way for them to win the 2020 election was to cheat. Remember, they are the tyrannical minority. I have brought you those historical stories. If you have not listened to them, go back in the archives over the last 6 to 8 weeks and listen to them. It is history. It is playing out again. History repeats before your very eyes. You will understand much if you listen to those historical stories and my tie-ins to current events. That is why H.R. 1 was passed now, folks. Because H.R. 1 is the only way these slime balls can keep their greedy little mitts and their nasty little non-human tendencies on power. It is what it is. I'm going to talk about the Delta variant. Oh, wait to hear these stats. You're not hearing them anywhere else. The Delta variant, shall we? Once again, there's no coincidence that H.R. 1 was passed a few days ago. It ties in with Afghanistan, and it ties in with this whole play on the Delta variant. You know, that super communicable, it's going to kill you variant of the disease that's going to require booster shots and all sorts of things. Look, this is all nonsense. I know some of you wrote me and said, oh, this COVID is old news. Well, you know, it's not old news. I'm in Idaho here. This is a red state. Now, true, Boise has blue streaks. It has one of those loony mayors, a Democratic Marxist mayor. There's all sorts of high-tech people moving in here from Washington, Oregon, California. Unfortunately, sorry, folks. But the great majority of the Idaho folks who, by the way, are terrific folks, that I've talked to at the state fair are disgusted, incensed, bewildered, and growing increasingly angry at the democratic Marxist policies, the policies and tyranny of the minority. They know that we are the majority. In fact, we are the super majority. And so do the democratic Marxists. That's why H.R. 1 was passed in the House. By the way, you better be writing your senators, telling them not to vote for H.R. 1. I won't say it's the ball game, but let me tell you that they will be on third base with a long lead toward home plate if it gets passed. And they're using the Delta variant to try and set up the same type of fraud which was so successful for them using COVID and health, which they couldn't care less about, in the 2020 election. I mean, it is glaringly transparent to anybody who is watching this and employing their mind thinking outside the box. I'm going to bring you stats next week on the VAERS reports. There was an excellent report by Children's Health. Let me just tell you that they're saying that the deaths from these vaccines are 176 times, and that's just the VAERS reports. Those are voluntary reports. 1%, according to Harvard, of the actual things going on. They're 176 times the deaths associated with flu vaccines. They're estimating that Israel, which by the way did a study called the Dagon Study, 35 to 86,000 deaths due to COVID in those vaccinated. Here's what's coming out in all these international studies which the American media, the American government, the FDA, Big Pharma, and tricky Tony Fauci, fraudulent Fauci, and his cabal of democratic Marxists and globalist buddies are suppressing. There are now more people dying of COVID who are vaccinated than people dying of COVID who are not vaccinated. By a lot. By a lot. There are far more serious adverse reactions and consequences which are now beginning to manifest themselves. Cardiac, neurologic, hematologic, vascular, from people who are vaccinated than people who are not vaccinated. These are just stats. They are science. It is irrefutable. Studies with by folks, by the way, who have no axes to grind. They are strictly scientists and health experts, virologists and immunologists around the world. Massive studies in Israel, which is the most vaccinated country on the planet. And by the way, in total lockdown. Oh, they're the most vaccinated, but they're in total lockdown. Australia, where there's a million people in the streets saying, hell no, same thing. You're not hearing about those demonstrations or uprisings, are you? You're not hearing about the millions of people in the streets of Europe saying, hell no. By the way, where are the millions of people in the United States saying, hell no? Isn't it about time, folks? And I don't mean just on the vaccine. I mean all this nonsense. Did you know Oregon imposed a statewide outdoor mask mandate a few days ago? I want you to think about that for a while. This is the vaccine, you know. You're all supposed to be safe and immune, and you can't transmit it. Oh, and by the way, Oregon's blue state. Lots of people vaccinated up there. Nonetheless, if you go outside, you have to wear a mask. Oh, is there anything wrong in this picture for you? Let's talk about a UK data study that was done by an absolutely apolitical outfit. Two-thirds of the Delta variant deaths in the United Kingdom are in vaccinated people. Through the 1st of February to the 2nd of August, the United Kingdom recorded 742 Delta deaths. Oh, let's talk about something for just a moment before I continue. That's out of 300,000 cases. Do the math. The Delta variant is supposed to be so deadly. 742 people, more than 50% of them in the over 50 age group with comorbidity conditions, is the total number of deaths in the UK from the Delta variant. Of the 742 deaths, 402 were fully vaccinated and 79 had received one shot. Only 253 of those 742 folks that unfortunately died were unvaccinated. The 402 deaths represent a tiny percentage of the 47,008 cases in vaccinated people in the UK. 253 deaths out of 151,000 cases resulted in the unvaccinated. I want you to think about that percentage for a moment. 253 unfortunate souls, half of them in the at-risk categories. Is the sum total of deaths from the Delta variant in the UK, which, by the way, has been hit hard with Delta variant infections. 253 out of 151,000. That is in the hundreds of percentile for fatalities. This data is supported by data from others. Let's take Israel. 60% of the hospitalizations in Israel are in fully vaccinated patients. 60%. And you know, we're now talking about boosters. Oh, Tony can get his royalties and Big Pharma can get their money. And the government can impose their controls, their mask mandates outside for the vaccinated. And of course, we can pass HR 1 and perpetuate, if they hope for eternity, the election fraud of 2020, codified into law, no less, unless it's struck down. Finding in these international studies, which somehow just aren't making it into the American press, or, you know, out of the edicts from the CDC or the NIH or blue state governments, the huge majority of folks who are vaccinated are the huge majority of folks contracting COVID. And even though the death rate is way, way, way down, I mean, like infinitesimal, the majority of the deaths are in vaccinated people. What they're finding is that the viral loading of SARS-CoV-2 in folks who are vaccinated is anywhere from 30 to 100 times the viral loading of SARS-CoV-2 in folks who are not vaccinated. Actual stats from the UK study, which was extensive and really one of the best that I've read. Total Delta, by the way, Alpha, the Alpha variety, there's like 8 varieties of COVID now. Gee, what happens? Oh yeah, that's right, viruses mutate, that's what they do. The Alpha variety, the original COVID strain, far more deadly, even though minimal deaths, far more deadly than the Delta cases, which everybody's jumping up and down about, and the press is wooing about, and everybody's on Ron DeSantis and Governor Abbott about. Delta cases in the age group under 50, 265,700, I'm rounding numbers. Unvaccinated, 147,000 of those cases. Received 2 doses, 25,000 of those cases. 1 dose, 40,000. And 1 dose within 28 days, 28,000. All cases, 96,000 cases with advanced viral loads, the majority of which were vaccinated people. 24,000 with 1 dose in 28 days. 46,000 with 1 dose in a longer time period, and 47,000 receive 2 doses, 151,000 vaccinated folks getting Delta. Cases with an emergency care visit, 6,000 cases, 500 cases, and 7,600 cases, all in vaccinated. Cases with emergency care, same type of statistics. Deaths within 28 days of getting a positive COVID test, 205 deaths in the unvaccinated, 389 deaths in the vaccinated. This is right out of the UK study. I'm reading it from the chart. Boggle your mind with a bunch of statistics. The science is irrefutable, folks. Vaccinated people are more susceptible to getting COVID, and they are more likely, even though it's a tiny percentage, likely to die than unvaccinated people. The Faucis of the world, the control freaks of the democratic Marxists in countries around the globe, are focused on control. They are focused on election fraud using health and fear as their fulcrum. Remember, their weapon is fear. That is what they have. They don't have the majority. They don't have the policies. They don't have the law. They have only fear. You need to do some research on this. I'm not telling you this, you folks who are vaccinated, to get you upset. I'm telling you because you need the information. It is critical. Next week, we're going to talk a little bit about the games Pfizer is playing with the supposed approval of the vaccine. Nonsense. Another lie being told to you. The vaccine has been altered. That altered one has been approved. They're now using that to push mandates and passport vaccines because it's approved, you know. It's not just experimental, except that the doses that are being given are still the experimental batches. They want their cake and eat it too. They want the immunity from a vaccine preparation and delivery that the law affords them, unfortunately, while at the same time dishing out all the goodies that they've concocted in their labs in all sorts of various concoction batches, which you are taking in your arms to do the research. Vaccinated, unvaccinated, one shot or two shots, get acquainted with what's going on out there. This is your life. This is your family's life. This is the health of you. And by the way, the health of you is the health of your country. This is important stuff. And we are out of time. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Next week, the food shortages, a collection of court rulings which will boggle your minds, and the giveaways to China by President Cadaver and President Obama.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.